on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Good morning. Welcome aboard. On this episode of The Big Fish, we continue our discussion with fly fisherwoman April Vokey, looking at April's fly fishing adventures here in Australia. Fishvember wraps up at a little school in New South Wales. We'll catch up with the assistant principal who's brought this great initiative to the school, which has really been a fabulous idea to encourage families to get out on the water. Great social currency. Speaking of families, Stinker is back from a fishing trip to Broughton Island with the grandkids that didn't quite go to plan. Roden Woodhams has the Sydney offshore scene covered, chasing giant blue marlin. Pretty exciting. Watch you don't end up a shish kebab Roden. They do get a bit aggressive near the boat. And we'll catch up with Matt Barwick from the National Carp Eradication Initiative to find out where they're at with the science before they say yes or no to releasing that biological control, the herpes virus, into the environment. April Vokey spends half of her life living in the Northern Hemisphere on the giant steelhead rivers of British Columbia, swinging flies across double-handed rods, bay casting, a fantastic environment, dodging grizzly bears, living off the land. And then for the other half of the year, she's in the wilds of Northern Australia, fly fishing for our incredible saltwater fish. But before getting here, April really didn't know how good it was, she reckons.
I had no idea. Honestly, you guys are like the secret little treasure that people know about. And, you know, social media is helping to spread awareness, good, bad, or otherwise. But you guys are like this little buried treasure. I can't believe the amount of people who fly through here to go to New Zealand without actually fishing in Australia itself. It's crazy. Mm.
What about, Australian bass are still quite prolific, as long as we don't wreck their rivers and dam their rivers and whatnot. But you know, they're a wonderful fly species and very aggressive, and they pull hard. I from what I've talked to people about it, that they pull so much harder pound for pound than the bass in America, the largemouth bass.
Yeah, I mean, I probably put them more on par with maybe a smallmouth, which tends to pull harder. But my Australian bass fishing experience has been actually really incredible. They're extremely aggressive. And it's just so cool to, you know, we fish a lot of rivers up, but we've got a place not that far out of Coffs Harbour. And there's some great rivers over there. And it's just so surreal to be fishing for jewfish in the morning and then, you know, turn around in the afternoon and be fishing for bass. It's just really, really special.
And on surface flies, bass, I think, are probably one of the greatest things ever. You can get so much action too, can't you, on a warm night with the thunderheads building, the cicadas drumming in the trees. It's just exciting fishing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really funny. It's funny you should say that about the, you know, in the evening. It's been very surreal for me fishing at night, because in Canada that's illegal. Or in BC,
really?
Anyway, that's illegal, yeah. To fish for salmon or steelhead at night is illegal.
Wow, so, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. I actually don't know.
Well, they think people are up to no good.
Well, they probably are at that time of night.
What are you doing? Just fishing.
Yeah, right.
But of course, yeah, fishing into the night, fly fishing by sound for bass it brings in those other senses, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really exciting. There's a lot of boofing and bloop, bloop, bloop.
That's right. Isn't it just bloop, bloop, bloop?
Yeah.
It's great. It just gets your heart racing. It's just such good fun. And you've caught some decent bass by the look of it.
Yeah, we've had some really good days on the water. I guess we do a lot of bass fishing, actually, because sometimes we can't get out for marlin. So we do a lot of marlin. My husband and I do a lot of marlin fishing. But as you know, it can be difficult sometimes getting out there, depending on tides, et cetera, and just wind and weather. But the bass are always our go-to, so... We do a lot of that. It's very, very, you have to understand it's surreal for me because, I mean, there's bull sharks in a lot of these rivers. And I remember one of my first times fishing for them, I was dangling my feet in the water and fishing. And he said, you've got to be careful, you know, there's actually sharks in here. And I thought he was pulling my leg. And then this enormous, you know, pod of something came by and it was dolphins, but they came by and made this commotion, and I swear to God, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. It was one of the scariest moments of my life, but I never put my feet back in the water again.
Cod, you've had a go at the cod. They're a wonderful species, aren't they, on the fly? They're very aggressive too. When they're switched on, sometimes they can switch off.
Now, with the cod, I especially have a soft spot in my heart for the cod because they really, this is the only place that you can find them. And they are just such an incredible animal. I did a podcast actually with Cam and Katie, with Cam McGregor and his partner Katie Doyle on my show. And they really opened my eyes.
They're down south, aren't they? They're down,
yeah.
Yeah, on the rivers around Mulwala and those big rivers around sort of northeastern Victoria.
Yeah, and they did a bunch of work on the species, and then Cam obviously guides for them. But they took me around and really opened my eyes to how special they are. And I've got a real soft spot for the Murray cod. I would like to see more people in Australia aware of them, not just anglers, but people in general. And obviously fighting for them. I think that they could use a hand right now.
Oh, they're such a great sporting species, I must say, too. We're going for them in the Granite Country of the Northwest just after Christmas. I'm trying to do a grand slam. I'm trying to catch a cod on day one, a rainbow trout on day two, a brown trout on day three, and a bass on day four. And maybe an eastern cod if we come down through Dorrigo, Coffs Harbour Way, Arara River and so on. There are a few of the eastern cod up the Clarence as well, so maybe we'll see if we can even make it a New England handful.
Ooh, I'll have to follow that. And see how
all on surface fly too. You've got to make it harder, haven't you?
Oh, I suppose if you really want to do that to yourself.
I've been reading McGuane's fabulous book, The Longest Silence, and
my favorite.
It's a fabulous book, isn't it? I just started reading it actually. My son, who has caught the fly fishing bug, is onto it. I'm so happy about him actually wanting to do it because it's my passion like yours, fly fishing. I just love it. And I don't know why, but I just love it. But his chapters on permit are quite extraordinary. And then you talk to blokes like Starlow, who's got onto them up north, a different type of similar, very similar. And, they've been biting floating crabs and catching them cast after cast. And it can be so hard in the Bahamas and so easy sometimes or so hard in Australia. What about permit? Have you been able to tangle with the Australian variety?
Okay, so they're ruining my life here. They are literally, I'm in my living room right now and I'm staring at three different permit paintings on the walls because I'm absolutely obsessed with them. And I can honestly tell you, this is no BS here. When Charles, my husband, was trying to get me to move here, I would say 75% of his battle to get me to actually live here is because you guys have permits. And they're incredible permits. Your guys' permits are so beautiful. And totally, a lot of people in North America don't even know that you guys have permit. It's crazy. Fishing for them is exceptional. Oh, God, they make my heart go. Yeah, your guys' permit fishing is enough to make a Canadian move here.
Well, I interviewed Starlow once, who just happened to be up north when it coincided with this hatch of baby crabs that were floating, and the permit were smacking them off the top. And he said it was just like a conveyor belt of crabs and permit. You put a floating crab on, you got one every cast. And I was thinking, poor old Tom McGuane, and his quest for them, and it was just so painful and so hard.
It's painful and hard here too. Do not be disillusioned.
Yeah, I've never caught one, so I don't know. Who's the favourite person you've interviewed in the podcast? It's called Anchored, by the way. It's a great fly fishing podcast. You want to hear some excellent characters like Frenchie and Morsi, a couple of regulars on this program, telling great stories. Who's your favorite? Is it not to put off Morsi or Frenchie because they're everyone's favorites, but who's your favorite?
I think probably John McMillan. He's a steelhead biologist in North America, and he's just brutally honest. I mean, the show is uncensored. It can be mildly offensive to some. I ask some relatively hard questions. I let people say whatever they have to say. But John he manages to really educate people, not only about conservation, but steelhead biology and how it relates to how you fish for them. So he's one of my favorites. And then, of course, I just have, sometimes I'll have random boat hunters on the show because that's another passion of mine. And so Steve Rinella is interesting. Joan Wolf is interesting. A lot of the, you know, Gary
Wow, Joan Wolfe would have been, Joan Wolfe would have been really interesting. She's incredible. Yes. And
yes, her last interview, it was a really emotional interview for both of us.
Oh, amazing woman, amazing, and what about an amazing man too? The Wolf series of flies are just probably the greatest innovation for trout fishing ever, aren't they?
Yeah, you have to listen to it. She talks about how she met Lee, and I didn't know if she'd actually go let me go live with it, because she openly talks about leaving her husband and her children for Lee, and they met on a fishing trip when they were filming a TV show. And yeah, she listened to it before it aired, and she said, go for it. So it is a really interesting story, her and Lee.
I'll have to go back to that one. I think I did download it. I don't think I've had a chance to listen. That's a great thing about podcasts. They're there forever, aren't they, too? You can go back and reference them, and they're quite timeless, your podcasts as well. And they become more important, don't they, as you know, some of these older states people of fly fishing move on. But interesting. And what do the North Americans think of your Aussie? Greg French is a fascinating guy, isn't he? What do they think of his theories and things?
They loved him. You know, he was one of my more well-received podcasts by the North Americans. Because when I moved here, I did get a lot of people saying, oh, God, you know, all his guests are going to be Australian or Kiwi now. And, you know, I very much try to space it out. I try to space out all the different countries so that we're not stuck listening to one accent too much. But he was probably one of the better received episodes for sure. People just love him. He's so funny in his own way.
He's a great guy to fish with too. He really is a very generous bloke. And he's so funny. You know, he's been spending so much time in that dense wilderness and climbing up onto the plateau and those untracked lakes everywhere. And I was thinking, I said, oh, look, I'm tossing up between buying some just using regular boots or wading boots. You know, these wading boots are quite dear. He said, what are wading boots? He said he wears Blundstones, you know, those.
It's like, honestly, he is the most enthusiastic. I think he's probably the most enthusiastic person I've ever fished with.
Yeah, he's a great guy, Frenchie. He's certainly fabulous. April, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us. It's really, really interesting what you do and how fly fishing is such a big part of your life, both professionally and from a recreational point of view. It's wonderful. That's what someone once said, do what you love and you'll never work.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think Lee Wolf said, a golfer never burns his golf ball, so why should we kill our fish?
I love it, exactly.
Good to talk to you, April Vokey. We could go on forever, but we've got to keep rolling down the river on the big fish. Appreciate you joining us on the program, and if people would like to catch April, her podcast is there on demand for free as well. You can download it. It's called Anchored.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Scott.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Matt Barwick is the coordinator for the National Carp Control Plan and was carping on the other day on the ABC, the Big Fish program, about all of the research being done, all of the science being done before there's possibly an environmental control released, a virus released into the environment that attacks the carp. One question I really wanted to ask you, Matt Barwick, and welcome back to the Big Fish.
Thank you.
You've been travelling the land talking to people and explaining the science and the research and where you're at this stage. But one thing I wanted to ask you, is there a danger that the release of this herpes virus could lead to resistance in the wild carp or the feral carp that could then lead to a resistant super carp popping up in the environment that's even worse than the one that we've got now?
Look, the answer to that is pretty complex. And broadly, I guess, I would say it depends. So when we look at viral biocontrol agents, there are some examples where genetic resistance have developed over time, and there are some where there's much weaker evidence that that's the case. But irrespective of whether genetic resistance in carp might develop to this virus over time, we should plan as if it might, and we are under the National Carp Control Plan. So what that looks like is having complementary, so additional control measures for carp involved in this process. You know, when we look at rabbit control, for example, they started investing in a more virulent strain of the Khaleesi virus to release once the original Khaleesi virus started to wane in its effectiveness. We can and should be looking at similar approaches for carp. and also other control approaches for carp, including genetic control and all the traditional control approaches that have been used to some localised effect. All of these things will play a role in making sure the carp numbers don't just go down if we release this virus as a biocontrol agent, but stay down in the long term.
So you need a follow-up strategy to this virus, perhaps a different strain, a stronger strain or a different strain that will trick the carp that may genetically create resistance?
Well, what we know about any successful pest control case study around the world is that they all use more than one approach to do the job. So they call that integrated pest management. We know that the carp virus will give us a level of success and that we can build on that level of success by applying additional measures in years and decades to come to keep a handle on carp numbers and carp impacts. So that's definitely what we're looking at. There's some really interesting innovation in genetic approaches for the control of fish, including carp. And we're looking into that. And again, as I said, more virulent strains of the virus and other approaches to really ensure that we don't just get the result that we want for a few years, but we get the result that we want, which is obviously clearer waters, less carp, more native fish and water birds and other things that are impacted by carp. So the better long-term results for decades to come. We're already building on quite a significant body of work internationally and in Australia that demonstrates that common carp are the only species affected by this virus. So a whole range of species, not just from North America, but throughout Europe, have been tested, and only common carp developed the disease caused by the virus that we are considering using in Australia. That's a really important thing. We also know from the research done in Australia and overseas that this virus, under the right conditions, kills carp incredibly effectively. So mortality rates of upwards of 70% and sometimes approaching 100% have been reported in certain circumstances. But to get those sort of kill rates, we need to use the virus in the right way. And that's very much what the National Carp Control Plan, what we're working on right now, is helping to identify how we could use this to best effect.
Until you get the science right, and I know you're rushing slowly towards ticking every box about resistance, about what to do with the fish kills, you know, the whole gamut of science is being done with the money that you've got. What about us eating them or exporting them or using them for offshore cut baits? I mean, there's a lot of protein there that's just sitting in our fresh water going to waste at the moment. Can that have an impact on their numbers?
It's a really interesting point that you raise. So there are two very different matters that we're talking about here, which is, could we ever use carp as a resource? And the second dimension is, could we ever fix the carp problem in Australia by harvesting them? So people do currently make money from harvesting and selling carp, and recreational fishers love catching carp, and they're all great and valid uses of a resource, but you could never fix the carp problem in Australia by commercially or recreationally harvesting them. The reason for that is because carp infest about 1 million square kilometres of catchment in Australia. A lot of that is pretty inaccessible country. You could never access all that country to fish carp in throughout everywhere where they occur. Compounding that, a single female carp can produce a million eggs in a single spawning event. So the take home message from that is they're almost everywhere, and there's a lot of them, and fishing, recreational fishing removes about 0.9% of a population of carp. Electrofishing, so putting shock into the water, which is something, an approach that commercial fishers use, that removes about 14% of a population of carp. So what I'm really trying to explain is these approaches are useful for harvesting carp to sell and for people to eat and use for cray bait, and they're all valid uses. But they won't fix the ecological damage that is wrought by carp. We need to do something different for that, and biological control is the only approach we have on the shelf that could fix that problem.
And with such a vast amount of our fresh water from the coastal rivers to the inland rivers and lakes infested with these things, how do you spread the virus to every corner? Because it's quite important, I guess, to get rid of as many of these as you can. That's how resistance would develop, if you've got large numbers of them still there, sort of thing, that aren't exposed to the virus?
Well, that's something that we're exploring through our computer modelling under our research program. So biological control of carp is already the most well-studied vertebrate pest biological control case study in the world, and we're spending another $5 million to really help to understand how we could use this effectively. One of the things we're doing is that computer modelling to help us to understand how should we release the virus to get the best results. So the sort of questions we're answering are, how many release locations would we need? How many carp would we need to infect at each one? And most importantly, what happens to the overall populations of carp? But see, biological control is very different from commercial fishing, for example. As I mentioned, you know, there's a lot of inaccessible areas where it's hard to get a boat in to harvest carp. Well, that virus is sort of self-perpetuating through populations. As sick fish move through a population, they infect the naive fish. And so it's very different. So the challenges that really prevent fishing from ever fixing this problem really don't apply when it comes to using biocontrol. That's one of the reasons we're so interested in it.
Got any date for release, or is it going to be a lot more science, a lot more water under the bridge before you can actually definitively say we will do this?
Look, it's a really important point you make. So no decision has been made regarding the release of the virus yet. That's a decision that will be made by governments at the end of next year and informed by the National Carp Control Plan that we're developing now. So right now we're feverishly working on the plan and making sure that it's informed on the best science available. That plan will simply articulate, should we go forward with this, if so, how, and what will be the benefits and what will be the costs. And that'll inform that decision at the end of next year. So, yeah, you're right. A lot of research going on, a heck of a lot of consultation. So we're currently doing over 80 events throughout 40 locations around Australia between October and February next year, you know, sharing what we know and, most importantly, asking what's important to people in carp-affected areas. And all of that will help shape the plan that we deliver at the end of next year. And we're going to be in Maitland, Muswellbrook, at that sort of not far from where I live, actually, next week. So a lot of the Hunter region. Of course, Hunter, you know, there's carp aren't just a problem in the Murray-Darling Basin. They're in a lot of east coast drainages as well. You know, the Richmond River, a lot of the Hunter, the Hawkesbury River, Shoalhaven River, and they, you know, they're a bit of a problem in a lot of those areas as well. So it's not just a problem for the Murray-Darling Basin. It is a truly national issue, and that's why we need a national approach. That's exactly what the National Carp Control Plan is all about.
Thanks for your time, Matt Barwick.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon. Bye.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Here comes Tinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find them? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Good morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott. How you going?
Going well. Last week on The Big Fish, you were preparing to head over to Broughton Island with your grandchildren for the first time. How did the trip go?
Oh, sensational. It was just a wonderful family experience. The weather was magnificent. The sea, which is can ruin a trip, was flat as a billiard table. It was just absolutely beautiful. So we shot over there in a calm sea. We had spent three lovely days in the sunshine, and then we shot back on a calm sea, and the kids just had an absolute ball.
And what about the fishing, Stinker?
Well, that's another story. There's a funny thing about fishing. There's a few things that you want to avoid in my book of fishing. One of them is a calm, flat, miserable sea, especially if you're fishing close. If you fish out in deep water, it doesn't seem to matter all that much. But if you fish around close, as I do, a very, very calm sea is not on your side. Also, you like the water to be beautiful and blue, opal, and nice and clear. And that's another thing. And the third thing and the most important thing is you want the water to be reasonably warm. Well, in the case of the last 3 days, through the middle of the week, the water was frigid. I've never experienced, after 30 or 40 years going to Broughton Island, the water so chilly. I reckon it was probably 15 or 16, you know, something like that. It was cold. And when you drive into Esmeralda Bay, when you motor into Esmeralda and you look over the side in good conditions, you can see fish, whiting and brim and ludric and mullet, all swimming around. You can see them there. This time, There was none. I thought, oh, this is not a good sign. The sea was tea-coloured. Now, that happens in a, if a nor'easterly persists, and there's going to be someone tell me one day why the sea changes colour. And it was as flat as a flounder. So with all those things against me with the fishing results were, relative to what I've caught in Broughton Island in the past, quite poor.
Oh, well, it's the way it goes. It's the way it goes. But the kids had a good time?
Oh, kids had a ball. But to say it's poor, I mean, we got four or five snapper, but nothing sort of, oh, gee, a kilo and a half, 2 kilo with the best one, but he was one, and then varying down to sort of, you know, I suppose, a kilo. So there was, and then a lot of smaller fish. So there were fish there, but nothing. A lot of water between them, Scott. A lot of water between them. Oh, I got a nice flathead off the beach there, and then I caught a couple of brim, and I got a couple of bonito. So, I mean, we didn't starve, but it doesn't come up to the expectations. But as to tell you the truth, I didn't care two hoots.
Would have been exhilarating jumping into that beautiful North Beach and having a bit of a swim. Did you do that?
Oh, yeah, I jumped in all over the time because it was hot. It was quite hot out on the beach, and then, of course, it was very cold in the water, but it kept you awake, you know. But it's just such a beautiful place, and the national parks were there. They're doing a lot of work over there. They've got a little hut on the island, national parks, and it's always full of workers, and they're right into the place, and it looks a picture. It absolutely looks a picture.
Ah, lovely. And you ran into an interesting bloke who we had on the Big Fish a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I did. I knew exactly who it was when I saw him hop out off the boat onto the island. It was Scott Bevan, who's an ABC legend in the ABC.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, a brilliant journalist and reporter, yes.
So we spent quite a deal sitting in the sun and just having a good talk and finding out about each other and about Broughton Island. And, oh, look, he is a very nice person.
He is. That book that he's got out too, from a kayaker's perspective, the fisheye view of Sydney Harbour, it's called The Harbour. And we reviewed it on The Big Fish the other day. Some great stories about fishing and sharks and people on Sydney Harbour and the characters on Sydney Harbour. And it's a tome. It's a huge book. You could use it as an anchor, I said to Scotty, for his kayaking.
Yay.
But he loves the water. So that's interesting who you meet on islands, isn't it? You met that famous actor. We had him on the program the other day. And
yep, Shane Worthington. That's
Shane
right.
Worthington. You ran into Shane when he was shipwrecked and so on and so forth. What about the bloke who tried to walk home? That was a story you told me over a few beers once on the island. I couldn't believe that yarn.
Oh, well, people do some silly things on the island. They tend to go a little bit sort of loony, I guess you'd call it. But one fellow, he probably had a few too many beers too, Scott, I'd think. Anyway, he told me that he'd spent enough time on the island, he intended to go home, but he didn't have a boat. And I said, well, how are you going to go? He said, I'm going to walk. As well, I said, that could cause a few problems. I said, we're on an island.
Unless you're Jesus Christ, you might have a chance.
Well, I don't know about that either. But anyway, he said, I'll walk home. And I said, oh, well, that's going to be a challenge. Anyway, he said, oh, how are you going to do it? He said, oh, I've got a scuba tank, and I'm going to put enough weight belt on, and I'll walk along the bottom. This is fair dinkum. I know people at home in bed listening to this and saying, this just isn't true. But I tell you, I saw the bloke the other day. He didn't make it, by the way. He got about 30 metres. He got about 30 metres and ended up. And another fellow on the island, he said, where's Claude? And I said, well, he's decided to walk home. He said, you can't do that. He said, there's going to be a tragedy. I said, well, I couldn't stop him. He's going to walk. And then this other guy, he put on a wetsuit and face mask and had a big lamp. And he was going to go walking into the... anyway, it just went on and on. And then they both emerged out of the water sort of half an hour later. And he found him sitting on a rock in 30 foot of water.
In the pitch dark.
In the pitch dark, yeah, sort of. Their stories, there are a lot of other stories. The stories you can tell about Broughton Island, and that's a borderline story.
That is one we maybe, yeah, it's just extraordinary. It's just extraordinary. People do crazy things, but you remember those mad things, don't you? You do remember those mad things. It's a fascinating place, and you did write a lot about it, and there'd be more stories than you've collated too, wouldn't there?
Oh, look, you've got to be, when you write stories about people, you've got to be careful what you say.
That's
yeah,
right.
But, you know, but I still see Claude around, and Claude's the only bloke who I've ever seen try to walk 8 nautical miles along the ocean floor home because he was homesick. Anyway.
Yeah, he survived. He survived the tail.
He survived. Yeah, that's it.
Hey, tight line, Stinker.
All right, Scott.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
The social currency of fishing is something that we often talk about on this program, The Big Fish, and the way that it brings large groups of the community together, young and old, all the demographics. And Chris Franklin is the deputy principal at Holy Cross School, Kincumber, and he's using fishing to bring the school community and their families together, and it's been an outstanding success, as you'll see from the photos on our podcast site. Amazing. Chris, welcome to The Big Fish.
Thanks, Scott.
I know you've got the boat on the back of the car on the trailer, and you're just about to launch again out after the Kingies on Broken Bay or one of your favourite haunts.
Well, that's the plan. It's going to be a quick one today. We have our Fishvember barbecue.
That's right.
And our prize draw today too. So I do need to be back by lunchtime.
Yeah, that's right, for the big presentation. Fishvember, tell us about it, because other schools listening to this, other keen angling women and men in the teaching fraternity could adopt this. This is a great model, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it's something we've been doing for 4 years now. This is our fourth year. We started, as I say, 4 years ago with 16 families that joined in. And the first year we did it just as a weekend. And what we found was it did limit people. And the year after we went to a fortnight, we had a few more. And the last 2 years we've gone for a full month and it's really built. And this year, 96 of our families. So we're talking 400 or 500 people out fishing over the month of November.
Fishvember at Holy Cross School. It's a beaut little community Catholic school. And the fish wall. Tell us about the fish wall at school, because it is the place on Monday morning. Hundreds of kids gather around it and talk and point and look. The fish wall is huge.
The fish wall's the focus. So right outside our library, we have a big display board. And as we go through the month, we start hanging pictures up as people send them in, and it grows through the month. Every day, kids are there. They're checking to see what's gone up. They're checking to see their own catches and brag with each other. And the conversations around it, they're teaching each other about fishing, and that's a great thing too.
And they're really reconnecting with their grandparents and their aunties and uncles, and mums and dads are very busy these days, so it's bringing families together and families of other kids, friends of families, sort of thing. The dads and the mums are pooling their resources at the school.
This has been probably one of our biggest successes, I think. So the feedback I'm getting from parents, one of them said it's great to see that James is spending more time with Pop, and Pop's a bit of a fisherman. James didn't like fishing this year, until this year, I should say. And he's out there with Pop now, spending time and handing down secrets from generations past. But James got into it because he was at his mate's house during November, and his mate said, let's go fishing for Fishvember. First time he'd been, he was hooked from the start. And what we're getting is kids out there together, families out together, families meeting up, extended family, as you say. And I think it's putting the Tom Sawyer back into kids. They're out there on kayaks and surfboards and paddling across the channel from the wharf, hitting the sandbanks and getting nippers and casting lures and just having fun together.
I was out there the other day. It was a beautiful, sunny, early Sunday morning, and I've got a little 5-horsepower motor on the 10-foot tinny, and a little kid in his life jacket and another little kid in his life jacket had taken Dad's tinny, and they were zooming up the channel, on their own, which I thought was outstanding. But they looked like they really knew what they were doing. They had soft plastic rods ready, and you could tell they were long, whippy, good quality jigging rods. So they were keen on it, and I just thought, good on them. Getting out, what an adventure! You couldn't do better.
It's what we did as kids, and it's what I remember doing with my mate as a kid. And I think we've sort of lost that in a generation, and they're not doing it as much. And hopefully,
well, their eyes are all going too, aren't they? Their eyes are going because they're not focusing on the horizon. They're not using their eyes to look for the birds working and the
and the tide running.
There's suntans going too. You don't get a tan sitting on the couch, Scotty.
No, couch surfing. It's The Big Fish, ABC Radio across New South Wales. ABC Radio Sydney, Chris Franklin is with us from the Holy Cross School. Fishvember has just wrapped up today at lunchtime, the presentation barbecue. And what I like about your Fishvember photo wall and online photo wall too is that people could just take pictures of the family fishing. It didn't have to feature a fish being hauled up. And there are a lot of pictures there of just people having a go. And they take us through the logistics of how it worked.
So that's the way it works. The idea is to get out and have a go, and the idea is to be out there and be together. So we started off, one of our granddads last year offered his service, and this year he held a fishing masterclass to begin Fishvember. And a lot of families who'd never been fishing came along, and he taught them some of the secrets and simple things, how to bait a hook, how to rig a line, how to cast a line. And one little fella's in year six, Mackay, who's just come out from England 2 months ago, all he wanted to do is catch a flathead, or a big flathead, as he put it. And he got some tips off Ken. And that was on the Friday night. The Monday, I had a photo from Mackay with a 66-centimetre flathead.
Oh, fantastic. Great eating fish, too.
Yeah, they are. And he was chuffed, but it's not about catching fish. It's about getting out there, and
That's
how it works. So to go into the prize pool, they just have to send a photograph with one of our fish tags so we know it happened during November. Not that we don't trust them.
Some people even had the fish tag photographed on their phone.
They did, yes.
I noticed that. So yeah, just take us through the logistics, because it's like all good promotions, it's the KISS principle, this one. How does it work?
So simple as we can be. So go fishing, you've got your fish tag, and you
which
take
is a little
photo.
Little like a parking ticket or something.
Yeah, pretty much.
A sticker or something.
Yeah, a little laminated ticket, or we did email it too, so as you say, some of them had it on their phone. And all we say is take a photo with your fish tag of yourself fishing and your family out fishing.
Because that's the Fishvember fish tag, so it's got to be in that month of November.
Must be in the month of November, because we don't send the fish tag until it starts, of course. And yeah, look, any picture that comes in, we put you in the prize draw. But you only go in the prize draw once, but you can send in as many photos as you like. And we've been pretty lucky that people in the fishing media have been very supportive of us. We've received heaps of help, and we've got over $1,500 of prizes that we're going
fantastic.
To share out.
And fishing-related prizes.
Fishing-related prizes. So people have come on board, and then we'll draw them out on the weekend. And if your name comes out, you go pick a prize off the table. Yeah. So as you say, we keep it simple.
I love the pictures of just the family on the wharf at Saratoga or Davistown or Gosford or Point Clare or wherever. You know, all the wharves are there to fish. They're wonderful platforms, and you'd be surprised at what you can catch. I mean, you can tangle with a dewey or a giant flathead or anything off those wharves. Lots of crabs were caught. The crabs are really doing their thing this year. It's been phenomenal, but just a picture of people fishing. It didn't have to have a fish in it, and I think that was the key to the success. And doing it as a draw, not the biggest fish, not the most fish, the way you've done it is just so simple and easily adopted, I think, by other schools.
Yeah, look, I'm happy for any school to give me a contact at Holy Cross Kingcumber. You can get onto me through our website if you just search us on the internet, or if you want to check our Facebook page, put a link through there. I'm happy to share with anyone what we're doing.
All right, meritorious captures. Not about you. I know you've been catching some good kingies of late. You're a mad fisher and you do catch some good fish, but what about the kids? Anyone, you know, I mean, the joy on their faces when you see these kids. It doesn't matter what they catch too. There was one kid with a giant pufferfish, and it was a great photo, wasn't it?
He was thrilled. It's not about the size of what they're catching. And for some of them, it's their first catch ever. Some of them, it's their first legal catch. And for some of it's just the fun of getting out there. We counted up, I can't remember the number of species. I think we got about 16 species the other day, including crabs and sharks and flathead and flounder and kingfish and tailor and eel-tailed catfish and all sorts of things. But yeah, have a look on the website. Listeners can hook up too and have a look at the photos.
Chris Franklin, more power to you. Fishvember, what a great initiative. Let's hope other schools pick it up.
Yeah, look, if we don't get the kids out fishing, we're going to lose those skills and it's going to be lost to the next generation. So we need to get them back out there.
And if you want your kids to be good at creative accountancy down the track, then turn them into fishermen.
Yeah, for sure, because they can stretch a size to make a limit. So there you go.
There you go. Hey, Chris Franklin, well done. You better get out now and catch a few fish before the presentation at midday today.
Yeah, that's it. Got to get back, get the sausages on.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on
and
ABC
with the Sydney
Radio.
Offshore Report. Roden Woodhams, the world's worst rod grabber. Good morning.
Yes, I am a rod grabber, Scott, and you want to be very careful when we have our little trip out with Mr. Craig McGill in Middle Harbour, one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And you want to be on your game because Mr. McGill, he knows how to hook the kingfish. And I promise I won't grab the rod, Scott. I do.
He's like Pavlov's dogs. He's as soon as that reel screams, he's leaping into action like some sort of psychopath. That's all right. I don't mind, mate. I don't mind. And with the offshore thing, if it's someone's turn and they don't pick the rod up quickly enough, well, serves them right, I reckon. I mean, you've got to get in there and do it, haven't you?
Well, Scott, my favourite one is like if we're fishing six up, we'll have a rotate time. So everyone's like on for half an hour. And the number of times that I've managed to land a marlin while the person who supposedly was up on strike next was asleep in the cabin, and they come steaming out of there, it's like, no, you're asleep. You're at the back of the queue. So you pace to be on your guard, particularly on Molly 2 or Fat Cat, where it can be a bit of a challenge. But talking about Fat Cat, Anthony and myself and the boys will be out on Monday and Tuesday. The offshore report has been pretty interesting. There's been lots of reports of, literally from Port Stephens all the way down to Browns Mountain. A bit quieter in the deeper water. We've had a couple of our mates have gone 3-2-2 on medium-sized blues and a couple of fast fish there. There's been a few stripes reported all the way down. The water's in. There appears to be a bit of bait around. So I think for this weekend, I think we're expecting a bit of a blow tomorrow. Sunday should calm down a little bit. But yes, there are marlin about. There was also a report coming off Newcastle about 3 days ago of a 22-kilogram dolphin fish. So yes, offshore is looking good. Current slowed down. Water's warm. Baits around, so I think this time next week people will be talking about a lot of fish caught. Just as an aside to that, there have been a really good run of jewfish off Stockton Beach over the last 4 days. My phone is pinged between midnight and 3 a.m. every day this week.
Right. Stockton Beach, there's a fair bit of real estate there. You're not being specific. It's a very long beach.
It is a very long beach, and you need to use your eyes and use your fishing smarts. You need to isolate a channel where there's a water flow in, a water flow out. You need to look for your banks and get yourself organised. But there's been a good run of fish. The largest fish in that cluster was 24 kg. And the boys finished up last night. They got 3 in that 7 to 9 kilogram range. So that's been pretty good and very happening. Also, Scott, you wouldn't believe it, but there's been more big kings caught in the Brisbane waters. I saw a photograph of 117-centimetre fish the other day. So there have been some very, very surprised jew fishermen who have been absolutely smoked by jewies that are peeling off, 50 to 80 metres of line and running straight under wharves. And they've been saying to me, I've never had a jewy do that to me before. And I'm just sort of nodding sagely going, wasn't a jew, it was a king.
Yeah,
There's a bit of that going on.
Well what can you do? I mean, sometimes you just can't stop them, can you?
Well, look, this is the mismatch. I can relate to you a circumstance on the bommy just inside the Barrenjoey Light 2 years ago where I did about $380 worth of lures in about an hour. And I started off fishing with 10 and 15 kilo gear, that cost me 2 lures. I went up to 24, that cost me another 2 lures. Went up to 37, that cost me 2 more lures. And then I tied some cord onto the bollards at the back of Molly, and that cost me 2 more lures. Because if they're striking the lure within 3 or 4 metres of the pinnacle, and the kings, we actually got a visual on those. Those fish were between probably that 11 to 15 kilo mark. And there's just no way you can stop them. There's a reason why all pro king fishing up and down the coast of Sydney prior to the traps in the 80s was done with lead line, Scott. And that's simply, the reason for it was simply this. If they're onto a piece of cord with a, you know, a 100 kilo leader with about 9 to 11 kilos of lead on the line, that was the methodology for pros to haul them out of places like Yellow Rock and all those close-in places the Kings used to hang in the 70s and 80s. So lead lining was the methodology. Simply put, we're just so blessed that we have them, Scott.
I've got a great mate in Newcastle down Caves Beachway who a pot of monster kings, you know, really big ones, 20 kilo plus ones, moved into a local gulch that we used to fish, a rock hot spot near Catho. And there was a bommie about 100 metres out. There was a cave and very reefy country. And we used to catch a lot of tailor there. And the kings moved in. And if you let your garfish or pilchard get to the bottom, they'd pick it up. And then you were stuffed. They would just do you every time. So he thought, I'm going to just keep upping the gear until I catch one of these. So he started with some sort of overhead reel, you know, very expensive. That thing blew up. Smoke came out of it and exploded. The rod snapped. So he went up to, in the end, he's got sort of Cairns Marlin type tackle. with that wouldn't stop them. In the end, he just had to give up because these reels were just being smashed. He had the dragon fall and he was in danger of being dragged in. If they want to go, it doesn't matter what sort of gear, if they're big enough, you really can't stop them. As our old mate Alex Bellissimo said, your only chance is to just put it into free spool and don't let them know they're hooked.
Well, the softly approach is very interesting. And that big king that came out of Newcastle Harbour about 6 weeks ago at 26.7 kg, that was caught simply because they were fishing, you know, on 10-kilo line and they didn't pull at it. And it wandered away from the wharf. So hopefully there'll be a few more of those caught in the weekend, Scott. There's been an amazing run of big flathead in the Brisbane waters at the moment. My good mate Nate Butch Steele was in his kayak up the back of Bensville the other day and came back with some amazing whiting taken up down the flat. So it's heating up. It's coming. Christmas is coming. I'm very, very excited. And I'll talk to you next week and hopefully regale you with tales of the giant blues that smashed us up yet again.
Yeah, the blue marlin, what a sports fish, 400 kilos plus if you're lucky. Good to talk to you, Roden Woodhams. Tight lines.
Same to you, Scott, and we'll speak next week.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.